So without, say, without that conversation with Satan, and without Job standing up to God, God would never have thought about what he was doing. That's the idea. So that's why Jung got into terrible trouble with the theologians, with Christian theologians, because he says, Jung says that God's behavior towards Job is so atrocious that God is unconscious. This image of that, this is an unconscious God. He doesn't realize what he's doing. And the theologians got, you know, very exercised about this and said, how can you say these things about God? Okay, but I think he's talking, Jung is, there are schools of thought about this. I think Jung is talking here psychologically. He says God becomes conscious, listen to this, God becomes conscious in the act of human reflection. Now, what does that mean? It's tricky. Does it mean that God is otherwise unconscious and needs a human being like Job to point out what's going on here? Or does it mean that when we start to reflect on our God image, we become conscious of our God image, and then the divine becomes conscious in us when we start to reflect in it? You can read Jung's text in both ways. And some Jungians read it one way. There are some Jungians who literally think that the divine is unconscious until human beings force it to reflect. Like if you work on a dream, you reflect on the dream, the self takes an interest in what you're doing, the self becomes more conscious by the ego's work on the dream. I personally don't agree with that interpretation, although I can see it. I think what one can read Jung as saying that the one's experience of the divine becomes more conscious as we reflect on it. And that's what Jung means by the transformation of God. That, as he says in, I think it's the Kochnik letter that somebody mentioned the other day, that as we go more and more into the unconscious, we will come across the untransformed God. In other words, images of the divine that we haven't transformed through conscious reflection. That's what I think Jung meant. Yes. Yeah. That's a more of a non-dual position.
Yeah.
Yeah. I'm inclined to agree. I was taking it a little bit further, but we can talk about that a little bit later. I think that since the self is consciousness itself, it is only the self that's conscious of anything. Fire doesn't need fire to warm itself. The self doesn't need another consciousness to be conscious of itself, because the self is consciousness. So I think if that's what Jung means, I don't agree with him. Okay? If what he means is what I think he means, then of course I do agree with him. But as I say, this is an argument in the field, and you know, who knows what's right here. How does it matter? Academics have this argument, and who cares? I read Jung to mean that our God image is unconscious as far as the human ego is concerned until we start to reflect on it. I don't know. Do you want me to talk about the argument with Victor White, or shall I stop and we just have questions? I could go on. What time is it? Oh, it's 5:00. Let's just have questions. There's an interesting argument that he had with Victor White, who was a Dominican theologian, but we can do that another time.
Yesterday you spoke of the self-authenticating experience of the numinous.
Yeah.
And today you're talking about narcissism, and I wonder if you could just speak to the difference between the two. Being stuck in one's narcissism and unable to see the truth of...
When you have a numinous experience, it's anything but inflating. I mean, it's actually a very humbling experience. Otto calls it, he says it produces what he calls the creature feeling. You feel small. So it has an anti-narcissistic effect. It has a tendency to make one feel humble. Whereas the true narcissist thinks he knows all the answers, inflated and self-important. So I think numinous experience, unless you identify with it, I mean, it's one thing to say I have an experience of the divine, it's another thing to say I am God. Well, you can say that if you're a non-dualist, but I'm in deep water here. But anyway, as a rule, these numinous experiences tend to deflate narcissistic structures. Does that answer your question? Thank you. Yes.
I would like to ask more about the for me what we skipped over a little bit, the father problem.
Yeah. Did I skip over that?
No, I just wanted to know. I'm thinking I remember as a child counting on the connection holding. In other words, knowing that my father had dark and light sides,
yeah,
but believing and trusting that the loving and the and side would hold,
mm-hmm.
and calling that into question, either with a question or a defiance, but trusting that his yeah. good would hold, and it did not. I got back the narcissistic, inflated, who the fuck do you think you are, or,
right.
or whatever. Okay.
Right.
What I remember inside, though, is turning to my what I thought was true, trying to hold to what I thought was true, and that became my faith life. In other words, my faith in God was born
out of the suffering.
Out of that.
Yeah.
And still, the fantasy was, I believe, though, that underneath he still was who I believed he was. Do you know what I mean?
Who was who you believe?
Both.
Oh.
That God was ultimately good, and that my father just somehow forgot.
Didn't realize.
Or slipped, or didn't
that's
know.
That's a very sophisticated
Well, that's what
position.
I'm wondering right now.
Yeah.
I'm wondering right now if my whole faith is based on a fantasy that upheld me as
no,
a child.
No, it's based on, I would say that's another, you know, I didn't get through all my varieties of numinous experience last night, but that's what I would call gnosis, G-N-O-S-I-S, a deep intuitive not knowing that you somehow had as a child, presumably carried over from past lives or something, that your father was mostly ignorant of his connection to the divine and so on. Somehow you just knew.
And that's
that.
Where the shock was. That's a creature experience.
Yeah.
There's a creature experience.
Yeah,
you know,
sure.
That the big one doesn't know.
Yeah.
My other question is more. I'm rereading the Odyssey right now, so I'm really confused when you say, even though I used to know it and used to think about this when I read Jung. When you talk about this is the first encounter with the dark side of God, because the Greeks were totally familiar with the dark side of God.
Yeah, okay. But remember last night I said that several pantheons have light and dark gods, and that the Greeks certainly had, they had Hecate and various dark gods, so that wouldn't be true for the Greeks, and I gave... Oh, you weren't here. Oh, last night I talked about Loki and Baldur, Set and Osiris... Ahriman and Ahura Mazda, that's three or four, there are probably some others, but most of the pantheons have light and dark gods, so it's that was the case worldwide until the Christians made it very, very light, too light. And what Jung is trying to redress that balance, because he's saying if you split off the dark side, lodge it in the figure of an antichrist, you actually are in a kind of dualistic tradition. You're no longer a monotheist, actually. You have two divine powers. Yeah. Hang on. I think you have to get the microphone.
I'm weary, so the name escapes me, but the mystical side of Judaism understands that duality of God
yeah.
and articulates it very well.
Oh, yes, it's in Judaism, no question.
From the very early text.
Yeah.
And also I want to clarify, the Torah is written with no vowels.
Yeah.
So that's important to know.
That's why it can be read in more than one way.
That's the problem.
Yeah, well, that's what I was trying to say, that we don't know the original. And as I said, in Amos and Isaiah and in various other places, in the Hebrew Bible, you do find a notion of the dark side of the divine. It's only when you get to, I don't want to labor this point. I think I've said it enough. Yes.
As I'm listening to you, I'm thinking that Judaism and Christianity, psychology and Western culture,
yeah.
I'm saying this as a non-Buddhist, but all of these things are creating constant koans,
yes,
that stop us short.
Yes.
They stop us short. And when we're in that place, something can happen.
I agree completely. I think the problem of evil is a koan, a problem that cannot be solved conceptually. I think you're absolutely right. Yes.
I think it's in the King James Version of the Bible that Job is described as perfect.
Yes.
And the only other person in the biblical tradition that's described as perfect is Jesus.
Yeah.
And that, you know, somehow there's a connection there. For me, the meaning of the book of Job is to refute the conventional wisdom that the good don't suffer. But it doesn't answer the question why. With Jesus and the crucifixion, I think Christians, you know, convoluted up the atonement to try and explain.